Blog Talk Radio.
The bloom, the swoon, the sugar's on your block. The planets let them flash in the corners of New York. The ghetto, the meadow, the Mr. Butterfly. The honey bugs dug and licked the honeybee. The sun, the kiss, the funk for a bit. The lips with the soul and some jazz for your hips. The puff, the buzz, the lids be heavy slick. The mecca get a rush when the beats be very thick. The hands, the feet, the brown baby treat. The femmes fumble loose and drink the doodle juice. The steps, the flams, the planets got damp. The people get a grip with the tape from a jam. A nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk.
A nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk.
A nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk.
A nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk. The big, the fat, the cool, cool cat. The psychedelic soul puts the planets on the map. The chic, the love, the far out name. The lack of the funk's the main, why we came. The boogie gets done, the colors won't run. The funk hits the square, the kids gotta come. The pizza with the pop, the West 4th stop. The crew after crew that do the grasshop. The true cool is black, the new school is fat. The beats by the ounce, the funk by the pack. The groove is the fix, the jitterbug fix. The hanging off the butts with the fat soul kicks. That's my nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk.
A nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk.
I said a nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk.
Oh, a nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk. The wide, the hip, dig it, it's the trip. The loops, the scene, and the funkifying it. The sounds, the pounds, the stacks, the flares. The baggy, baggy jeans, the naughty, naughty hair. The twinkle in the eye, the kisses living fly. The crew from the sky, the stuff that gets you high. The action, the work for the rhyme. We goes the whole nine. The papers won't rot, the vapors get got. The streets get the buzz, the funk off your block. The opium groove, the smacked out soul. The kicking it live, the fat gotta roll. With my nickel bag of funk, my nickel bag of funk.
A nickel bag of funk.
Yeah, it's a nickel bag of funk, a nick bag of funk.
A nickel bag of funk, a nickel bag of funk.
Nickel bag, a nickel bag. Ladybugger hit you with a nickel bag. A nickel bag, a nickel bag. Butterfly hit you with a nickel bag. A nickel bag, a nickel bag. Doodlebugger hit you with a nickel bag. A nickel bag, a nickel bag. DP's always hit you with a nickel bag.
Welcome everybody to Headliners Ball. This show's format gives both authors and audience alike the chance to entertain a deeper discussion regarding a choice selection of poems from the author's catalog of work. Headliners will perform pieces in their intended style. In turn, they will receive encouraging feedback from an all-inclusive panel of late-night poet callers. My name is Jeremy F. I am your host, and as always, I am joined by my beautiful, my talented co-host, Pam Ray, who is such a profound fan of the Godfather trilogy that she has committed the whole series to memory, so much so that if you have a spare 6 to 7 hours, grab a bag of popcorn and she will give you a full recitation with accents. Pam, how are you?
I am doing great. I'm busy, obviously, memorizing the Godfather trilogy, but, you know, life is good. I got to say, I'm excited. I'm excited and happy to be hanging out with you and other cool poets. It's going to be a great show tonight. And how are you?
I'm doing great, sister. I'm doing just great. Yeah, I'm like you. I think we have two really special poets tonight, and I wasn't incredibly familiar, in all honesty, wasn't incredibly familiar with their work. I had seen them on previous shows, other shows here on Late Night Poets, and read a few poems, but was very pleasantly surprised when I got to enjoy both their set lists this week. So I'm excited to dig in deeper.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We do have both our featured poets here. We have Daniel Deschino and Arliss D. Welcome, gentlemen. Glad you could be here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you, everybody. Really appreciate it. And the two first things I want to say is, Jeremy, awesome taste in music. That song is rocking. And Pam, we'll have to discuss The Godfather someday. It's the reason why I never eat oranges.
I know that you guys are both up late. Daniel has requested to go first because he's an East Coaster. I think you're a Central Coaster or Central Time.
Right, right.
So we're going to fire off Daniel's set list first. With that being said, Daniel, whenever you're ready, let's get moving.
Jeremy,
on the board. Yes.
Before we move forward, I would like to let you know that one more poet has joined us for reading, or not reading, but for commenting and joining in the discussion, and that is Sucker for the Treadmill. So welcome, Sucker. Glad you could join us.
Hey, yeah, thank you guys for having me. Looking forward to the show.
Cool. Great to have you aboard.
Hey, Sucker. Thanks for coming. So, yes, I appreciate the first go. I do have to get up in about 3 hours for work, so I would like to get some sleep tonight if possible, so I appreciate it. But, yeah, let's get the show rolling here. So this first one is called The Fate of All. The deception of present, forward-moving constant motion, never stopping, always changing, to dream, to grasp, to dream. One reality, billions of perceptions, sometimes changing, always destroyed, filling the black hole of history, an endless void endlessly filled, incessant numbers, countless lifespans, some faded with early demise, some blessed with longevity, some living to legendary stature, grasping to antiquity, or even wandering in the now, exceedingly drawn towards fiction, cryptic puzzle from time's blended mixture, reaching for a mythological peak, fusing fantasy and veracity, fuel for imagination, some with powers derived from power corrupt, to reach a divine position, eventually lost in the forgotten void, a fate inescapable, discovery, a narrow chance for salvation, reborn somewhere on the path, a repeated journey to be lost in time. End poem.
Excellent read. Excellent poem.
Very good. Very good.
Pam, start us off with comments tonight.
Oh, absolutely. Wonderful read here, Daniel. I always enjoy how so much of your poetry delves into the idea of, I'm blanking out on the word. It's so very thought-provoking. It really delves into, social issues and the idea of what society has become. I really like some blessed with longevity, some living to legendary stature, grasped into antiquity, or even wandering in the now, exceedingly drawn towards fiction, cryptic puzzles from time's blended mixtures, reaching for a mythological peak. And I think there's like a realm of psychology and so philosophy. That's what I was thinking. There's always a philosophical element. And I guess that would be my question in general about your poetry, because I noticed the philosophy about it. And is when you started writing poetry, did you, think to yourself as you start writing, I want to write the type of poetry that offers up philosophical thoughts, or did it just kind of become that?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I tried writing poetry a long time ago when I was trying to copy people that I saw, mostly lyrical poems, and it was horrible. Nothing worked. So I started trying to write seriously only a couple of years ago, and I did it purposely to promote thought and philosophical ideas, actually. It was something to do on LinkedIn, to be honest. During the pandemic, I wanted to put something else out there for people to think of, something positive and something to a little bit of distraction from the horrors that were going on. So I started posting things like this and found I had somewhat of a knack for it, or at least I enjoyed it and got good reactions. So honestly, I kept going. Interesting thing about this one is this is way out of my norm. This is not what my poems sound like. So, interesting to start off with this. And it's basically about a Lord of the Rings quote, which is present turns into history, becomes legend, becomes myth, and then becomes forgotten. And that's basically what this poem is about.
I like that. I like that a lot. Arliss, what do you have to say?
Okay, well, I didn't know you were going to be calling on me. I liked the poem a lot. It sounded very metaphysical to me. It had the sense of searching for something, eventually something very deep. I mean, we're talking about possibly an afterlife or the end of this existence, what's out there. My background is philosophy, so I enjoyed all of the philosophical nuance that was in it, and I thought it flowed well, and I found it very moving, especially toward the end. So I liked this quite a bit.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
See, I caught you off guard, Arliss, and you do a wonderful job of giving us a review. I didn't mean to do that to you, my friend. You can definitely.
No, that's all right. It's no problem. I didn't realize that you were going to call on me, but go ahead and do it anytime. It's not a problem.
Yeah. No, I didn't mean to catch you off guard. But I think go ahead, Daniel.
I was just going to say I did read some of Arliss's poems before we came on here, so this is going to be a battle of the poet philosophers tonight. I think.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah, it's central to my work. To maybe an excess for some people's case, but I've read philosophy for 50 years now and still going strong with it. So anyway, I enjoyed this from your poem, especially.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
You're welcome.
Sucker for the treadmill, what do you have to say?
I found this poem really comforting, I guess. Before he made the Lord of the Rings comment, I imagine like a really manic poet, like trying to figure out the nature of existence and kind of going crazy and making his own ontology and just sort of justifying it, I guess.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, cool ideas for sure. And I think so early on, Daniel, I have this whole list of questions I have for you. We kind of touched lightly on a lot of the things I want to delve in deeper to with you on as we go further. But what I found most striking about this, I enjoyed it immensely. I think you did a wonderful job of taking imagination and just – there's a lot of times when poems – and I'm glad we talked about philosophy. I'm glad we talked about a lot of this. But there's a lot of times when poems just take you on a journey, and it allows you to daydream while you're reading it. Pam and I have talked about this on previous shows, but a lot of times I get into poems and they spark so much thought and so much creativity in myself when I'm reading it. I get so inspired by it that it takes you on a journey each time you read it. I felt this in this poem. What I was most impressed by is at the end you say this contest got you out of your comfort zone, and you even self-admitted that this isn't your normal style. And you do a masterful job of it, and that a fan like me can get taken away by it. So I know that you had told me that you didn't necessarily want to go in the order on your set list and all of that, but this happened to be the first one on your list. And I'm just wondering, if this was something so far out of your comfort zone and it was so impactful for a reader like me, did you find that if you wrote it, what I read here is you wrote it about a year ago, did you find that this impacted more of your writing in the future after you wrote this? Did you continue to do this kind of style?
That's a really interesting question. One of the reasons I put it on here is I do have put myself out there. I do have a book coming out probably in the next week or two, and this is one of the ones that's in there. And it did influence me. I to me, this is a little bit cryptic, and I write, I try to write very simply because I'm trying to get a point across. I almost write sometimes in just, it almost sounds like just a train of thoughts. And I do that on purpose as well, too, because I'd rather, I usually write in a lot of layers where there's a main theme that you can get on the outside, but then there's kind of hidden themes. Always want to make people think as well, too. And then you always want to make it sound poetic and sound pretty. And sometimes I can have try to make the stanzas stand out as standalone poems. So I always try to have multiple layers on here. So this one actually influenced me really to stick with the more simplistic, philosophical, thinking, like introspective, but just kind of thinking about the world as opposed to trying to be a little bit cryptic. So, it influenced me not to do this style again.
Why is that? What about the style that you don't like? What is it that you don't particularly care for?
I actually really like this poem a lot. I was happy with this. I just like to be a little bit more – I like to be a little bit more simplistic in the style just to try to get the point across a little bit more.
Okay.
I don't – you know, I found some poems that I write sometimes if I get a little bit I'm trying to think of a word here. So a little bit cryptic, you know, people get a lot out of the poems, and that's great, but the point I was trying to get doesn't necessarily come across. So you know, I've certainly written styles like this, you know, something like this again, but I try to stay a little bit more simplistic just, again, to try to get the points across that I'm trying to get, so.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a good answer.
Yeah, fair enough. Great answer, my friend. Your next poem, Monolith of Light, is ready for you.
Excellent. Let me refresh here real quick. Yeah, this is an interesting one. Monolith of Light, Discovery. A call from the setting sun in the twilight of dancing silhouettes. I see the colors fade to black, and they speak to me. A rainbow sent from a star, splattered across the world. Then I listen. Colors speak, only to shatter reality. Am I a trick of the light? For I am not. All things exist in the dark, except me. How can something exist only in the light? I reach out to touch the colors, but it's just a reflection. I can't touch a reflection, no more than I can touch what's inside a mirror. What is reflected but the sun itself? I listen to this message delivered on beams of light. Oh, what a wondrous guide is illumination. Direction. A beacon through murky water's depth to behold the grand emergence of the first step, to breathe, to walk, to view the heavens. A glorious sunrise through distant trees, call to leap from the protective branches, stand tall. The first step towards the distant lands, the tools of contemplation await, just reach and grasp. I am awake, I am aware, I am conscious energy. I am ready to see the colors of the world, a reflection of your glory calling me, speaking to me the next great step on the journey, to reflect upon the world, to explore artistry, to discover. I hear the message, I reflect. What great step will sunlight bring next? End poem.
I love that close. I love that closing line. Arliss, you want to start us off?
I like this poem a lot. The imagery is really strong. There's a lot of natural imagery. The question about reflections, you know, how much, it reminds me of Plato, how much of this is real and how much of it is just a shadow dance before us, I thought that carried a good portion of the poem, just exploring reflection, and it's sort of evanescent. It doesn't really have being, but it still is there, and it can influence us and direct us. So I like it, and there seemed to be a sense of self-discovery here as well, which I think that. I, in my new book, I wrote an essay about the natural image, and I see the natural image really working in this poem to bring out the human side as well. I mean, there's an intersection there, and I thought that was very strong. So this is quite good too, and it doesn't seem very simple to me either. So I think it's still pretty philosophical.
I really appreciate that comment. It's a I don't even know if I want to call it a theory. It might be science fiction more. It was actually inspired by 2001: A Space Odyssey, the book, not the movie. If you've never read the book, you should absolutely read it. It's an amazing book. And basically, I thought of the monolith in there. I thought of what could really be a monolith, and I thought of the sun. The sun, to me, could have been the actual cause of life, the catalyst of the chemical compounds in the ocean. The heat and the radiation from that could have caused life to actually come out. And then, just I'll go quickly through it. Then, what are the little creatures in the ocean see? They see this kind of light flying around. Ooh, what is that? They try to come out of the ocean. That's the catalyst to get them out of the ocean. The next step. Then the next step is distance and, you know, being able to see off and wonder what's out there, and then be able to do that, you have to, you know, walk, or you're on 2 feet more, and you're using your hands and things to really get to these things. Now, where are we now? We're at that next step of evolution that the monolith might be trying to bring us towards, which to me, where we are now is abstract thinking, which is art, which is understanding colors and how to create things with them, understanding depth, and, you know, I'm wondering what's the next step in evolution that maybe the sun's bringing us. So, again, abstract kind of thought, theory, science fiction, whatever you want to call it, but that's where that came from.
Good. Nice explanation. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, great background. Treadmill, what do you have to say?
Man, I think the author described it pretty well. It's nice to hear a poem or read a poem that just automatically makes sense. And it was reassuring that he described it almost exactly how I interpreted it. I don't think I have anything to add after that in-depth explanation. But for me, somebody trying to learn to write, it's another comforting poem. Almost like a guide or a way to step forward.
I don't think I've ever had a better comment that I enjoyed. Thank you. That means a lot.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I really like it. I feel like a lot of poets write about, like, eating new writers or how they don't make sense or something, but this is it's different. It's more gentle, and you show the lesson of discovery, and then you give the direction, which is really cool.
Yeah, I was trying to almost write. It's a little bit of a take on, the novel, kind of how he wrote it. He had these kind of big sections, so. But I appreciate that.
Yeah, but that feedback, Daniel, I mean, that's exactly what you just described in the previous poem that you're looking for. I think that's awesome that Treadmill is taking that away from it. Very cool comment. You know, I really dig this, and when I read it the first time, it reminded me, I don't know why it stuck with me for so long in my life, but I remember hearing one of the questions when I was little from an IQ test, and it said, what color is a blue crayon in the dark?
Huh.
And obviously the answer was it didn't have any color because there wasn't any light. But for some reason, I don't know, that question and that answer, I thought it was a neat concept that things no longer have color when there's no light. And this poem reminded me of that thought. So this previous conversation that we've already had about, Daniel, about how you're inspiring philosophy and you're inspiring deeper thought, I'm telling you it's working, man, because it did it for me. And I'm cool that the conversation has led to this kind of revelation in your work, because – it's coming through in your audience, for sure. One thing that
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, no doubt. And one thing that I've noticed, and my question for you is, in the previous poem and in this poem, you've spoke of outside influences, like this one was 2001: A Space Odyssey. Do you find that when you're writing a poem, you're always – what is usually your inspiration? Where are you finding your muse? That's an easier way to pose the question.
That's a great question. First of all, does that mean that a blue crayon is not a color to a blind person? There's always little tricks with, you know what I mean? Like, I like IQ tests, but I don't know. Sometimes I disagree with them. Anyway, sometimes, honestly, when I've found the way to write, the other thing, too, when I said I was writing a long time ago and trying, I was trying way too hard. And I play drums as well, too, and I've found that if I just play, that's when things come out, and that's what I've started. That's what I realized here is I just write. So a lot of influence actually comes from the contests here. You know, I see a contest, oh, that's kind of neat. And then usually what I do is take a walk and just kind of clear my mind and think about it, and things just come. And I just start on this almost meditation of these thoughts and just kind of see what comes almost, see where I go. A lot of times I don't really know where I'm going with the poem. I'm just going on this little journey and kind of within my mind. I have 55 years of stuff that's happened to me all in there, letting it come out. Sometimes there isn't just, I'll start thinking. So I just started thinking about 2001 and that was an influence. It's not necessarily like I look for them. They just, sometimes these things just come, if that makes sense.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah,
about
that's how inspiration works. It just comes to you, and you've got to go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And somebody else had a question, I think. I'm sorry.
Were you thinking about, like, sentience or artificial intelligence?
That is an interesting question. Actually, I was thinking almost
of God. Especially the second
stanza,
like, really brings me into that.
I was, because that's what 2001 is about, but I was kind of almost thinking of God. You know, I don't want to get overly religious, but to me, the first page of the Bible is the Big Bang Theory. I mean, it almost says it outright there to me. Genesis, the beginning of Genesis is that. And to me,
Something
godlike is not just poof, here's the earth, poof, here's this. It's, to me, it would be the Big Bang. It would be this big, you know, grandiose thing that would take a long time to do. And I could almost see. So I was kind of thinking of sentient based on 2001, but a lot of it was almost religious. You know, how would God send that seed? Is that what? I'm sorry.
Like pantheistic, like the Big Bang creates the mechanisms that cause something like a refraction, and that's something you can't touch, but that you know is there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very interesting idea. You know, we can get into the whole, free will versus everything planned, right? That's always an interesting topic, but yeah, absolutely. So it was just interesting to think of the sun as like the catalyst of everything, and what's the next catalyst that's right in front of our noses that we just haven't really discovered yet, even though it's already there. So that was really my thoughts. Interesting. I appreciate all the questions.
Pam, what do you have to contribute?
Well, first of all, I have been thinking as I was sitting here from the last point poem where Dan had mentioned that you started writing during the pandemic of the coronavirus. And I think more people I know have started writing poetry during the pandemic. And it makes me wonder how much poetry came to light during the Spanish influenza.
It's a good question,
Exactly. But I really enjoyed listening to you answer the questions on this poem and your explanation for it. And there definitely is a sense of reverence for creation, for the sun, for history. And I really like it all the way through. And I'm not going to have a question, but of course my favorite part is, how can something exist only in the light? I reach out to touch the colors. Because as I've said before, I enjoy questions with poetry, because one of the gifts of poetry is, I believe, but as a poet, is that we get to lead people into thinking with us. And that's what questions do. So wonderful right here, Dan. Very well done.
I appreciate that. And the answer to the Spanish flu is less than now, because the Spanish flu ended faster than ours. So don't get me started.
Good point. I think my underpass, but that is a very good point.
don't even get me started.
I won't.
So, Daniel, before we go to the next poem, I want to give you the opportunity to selflessly plug. I know that you have your poetry available here on All Poetry. Is there anywhere else where we can find your work? Or do you want to talk to us a little bit about your book you're about to publish, even?
I'm published in the some Red Hibiscus anthologies, which actually came out of some poets here. There's a really talented musician, Rachel Walker, the Rachel Walker Trio out of Canada. She's actually bought one of my poems. It's on one of her albums, as which is really good. It got radio play and everything, so I'm proud of that. I've also been working with an author named Leanne Roberts, who wrote the Immortal Magic books. She just had her first book published, and I actually wrote some poems for her books to like open chapters and open the book, so that's out as well. And then I have my own book coming out called Conscious Energy, which those first two poems are actually in. And I'm hoping it's coming out probably next week is when it should be out. And it's with Sunny Day Publishing, so you can see it on there, and it'll be on Amazon and all over the place. So I appreciate the chance to plug.
No, how exciting, man. That's
congratulations.
Very cool. Up with the book. That's awesome.
Yeah, very, very excited. Trying to do a YouTube page with some readings and so forth. We'll see what happens. You know, there's 2 million self-published books on Amazon alone, and I know I'm with a publisher, but, you know, there's a lot of books out there, so we'll see what happens.
Well, being with a publisher, yeah, I always self-publish. That's impressive that you've gone that next step. I'm color me jealous. Right on, man. Good on you. And can you repeat, there is a song out there in Canada, you said, by a Canadian artist that is your words you sold the song to? Is that right? Can you repeat that for me?
Yeah. It's the Rachel Walker Trio. It's called Stream of Consciousness. And, she actually has some pretty serious musicians that play with her, some people who played with Steely Dan and so forth. She's a halfway popular artist. I met her on LinkedIn, and she wanted one of my songs, so I sold it to her for $50, first published thing.
How cool is that, man? Right on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, definitely put a link to your book on All Poetry so we can check it out and we know when it hits the street. That's very cool. Your next poem, Hidden Voice, is up and ready for you.
Excellent. Okay, Hidden Voice. There is silence within the sound I hear, but it is beaten into non-existence by noise, like an abused child forgotten at school and hiding in his room. And all the silent wants is a chance for life. And the sounds of the world rage with unapologetic ego. They don't ask the air. They can penetrate it so violently. They don't wait patiently for other sounds to scream in turn. And they do not ask my mind before they break in like a thief in the night to rob my memories of their innocence. But silence lay dormant like a flower in a battlefield, waiting to shine when the carnage is through. Who dares to see a flower through battlefield smoke? Who has the fortitude to hear what is not? Silence awaits those who will listen. End poem.
Great read. Treadmill, you want to go first?
Jesus, did you talk to my therapist recently? this one is almost personal for me, because I've been trying to write for several years, and it's always been in a frantic process of just trying to connect to people during hard times. And I'm always trying to sound smart or express something I learned in college or that I read. And it falls on deaf ears, I think. So I'm working on trying to stop and listen, and I think this is a really good expression of that pathological process that some people like me go through.
I really appreciate that. I always try to keep my poems open so you know that people can hopefully get something personal out of it. So I really appreciate that comment.
I was really struck by the extremes in this poem and how it travels. The extremes of a child, but then it's an abused child. The extreme of a battlefield, but then there's a flower in the battlefield. And then when you're talking so about all the loud noise and then the silence. and you don't experience true eerie silence unless it is accompanied by the other extreme. And so I really like how you were able to take this poem so far in comparing those two things on and off, and it really felt like that. It really left me with that eerie, hollow feeling of silence. And then the way it closes, silence await those who listen. It's like those who have been through it get to experience it more so. And so I think your extremes of this really painted that to a wonderful degree, and that was my biggest takeaway. My question to you on this one is, talk to us about some of your influences. Who are some of the poets that you use or have you followed in the past or that you're interested in? It doesn't even have to be poets. It can be philosophers. Anyone that's inspiring you to write.
Sure. And, you know, the real answer is every single thing and everybody. And I mean, because you can, you know, my opinion is you can listen to the great philosophers of the world, but then you can also be talking to a 5-year-old at your nephew's party and he can say something. You know, everybody has something to say. As far as poets, it's honestly, it's a lot of people on here. I mean, from Pam to, you know, the other three, you other guys on here, I don't think I'm very familiar with your poems, but I'm always being really influenced by people that I read on here, amazing poets. I think some of the best poetry I've ever read in my life is on this website. As far as famous people, it's a lot of musicians. Neil Peart is my favorite poet by far. He's also my favorite drummer. I think he's a very underrated poet. I like a lot of the pop culture people. I think they get a little underrated. I think John Popper of Blues Traveler is an amazing poet. I think Ani DiFranco is really, really amazing for her poetry as well, too. For her lyrics are amazing. A lot of that stuff is out there. You know, there's a lot of lyrics in rock and roll I think are underrated for their poetry.
Totally agree. Great answer. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, wonderful poem here. I like how, to me, there's this idea that there is a negativity in silence, but also, which is what touches on the most, and then in line, silence awaits those who will listen. I also feel like there's a positive, like, I don't know if it's positive is the right word, but the idea that silence speaks volumes. If a child is being silent in school, if they're not speaking, maybe there's a reason they're not speaking. As you say, like, you touch on the idea of violence and abuse. This is really a powerful and emotive right, and the sound of the world rage with unapologetic ego. They don't ask the air if they can penetrate it so violently. They don't wait patiently for the other sounds to scream and turn. There's this, it speaks to me on the constant fight for attention, and the people that get overlooked are the ones that need help the most. Just a beautiful and emotive write. And I know we briefly mentioned that you got started writing during the pandemic, and I liked hearing about the different poets that influenced you. But my question is about your drumming, because you obviously have two very distinct hobbies, you know, or gifts that, you know, relate to each other and yet don't. So, like, when you write poetry, does your drumming experience factor into that, or do you always, like, separate the two?
Yeah, that's definitely a really interesting question. And, you know, with this poem where you're talking about the silence, you know, I think that a lot of times during the day there's so much noise that it's noise. But when it's quiet, then noises become sounds instead of noise. And that's kind of what this is about. As far as the drumming, I mean, I don't think we get to this poem, but, you know, rhythm is really everything. Every single thing has rhythm in it. And I'm not really necessarily influenced by drumming when I write, but I always try to have some sort of a rhythm to the poem. And that's just something that I have with all of my life. So I definitely try to have some sort of a rhythm, some sort of a flow to it. So that would be the influence. Interesting question, Pam. Thank you.
Can you talk about the flow a little bit more? I mean, how do you literally write it down?
Yeah,
I'm always interested in how you incorporate rhythm and meter. You know, you're probably not writing meter, but how do you actually get that down on paper?
Yeah,
you rehearse it inwardly before you write it. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Honestly, I write 90% of the time when I'm taking a walk. I have my phone, I literally talk into it. I'm walking down the street and talking to myself, and I just kind of talk, and then I come back and look at it and kind of organize it. And you know, when I'm talking, when I'm thinking the poem, I'm always thinking of a kind of the way, I don't know how much you guys know about science fiction, but Isaac Asimov used to say he used to know kind of how his story started and what the ending was going to be. And the fun for him was finding what was going to happen in the middle. That was a surprise to him. And that's kind of the same way I write, where I know what I want to say, and I just got to think of that beginning part, and then the rest of it just kind of comes. I'm literally talking to myself on my phone. And then I come back and look through it and organize it and make it make sense and try to make a flow to it so that the lines kind of make sense. And then with rhyming poetry, I do – you know, not as much of that as free verse, but when I do, I try to make it rhythmic and metered and the same amount of syllables in each line that way. But it's really kind of writing the thoughts down and then coming back and organizing it and then publishing it. So it's a good, that's
yeah,
an interesting
that's
question.
Good, that's a good system. Do you rewrite a lot or not so much?
I try not to, because I'll rewrite everything. Like every single thing I'm looking at here, I'm like, oh, I should change this or I could add this. It's George Lucas says that art is never finished, ever. You have to basically say, okay, good enough, and put it down, because you'll sit there forever trying to fix it. So I try not to look back. I try to just say, okay, done. Let's move on, because I'll be there forever.
And move on, yeah. Okay, that's a good attitude.
Can I ask one thing about process real quick?
Sure.
Is what you want to say like a concrete thing that you have in mind already, like a distinct message, or is it more of like an idea or a feeling that you express as you're walking?
Yeah, it's interesting. It can change. Sometimes I want to say a specific thing, so again, I have that end in mind, but then other times, some of the stories that I've written or things like that, I don't necessarily know where it's going to go. I just kind of, you know, and it's just kind of coming to me as I write. So usually there's a – so with this, I wanted to say, you know, kind of tackle sound instead of just noise. And just – I actually remember writing this and walking down the street, and there was just noise everywhere. There was just cars and people talking, and there was just so much going on.
Yeah.
You know, John Cage would say that's a song. I understand why he would say that, for those of you know who John Cage is. But, you know, there's so much of it going on, you can't necessarily hear it. Whereas in silence at night, you stand outside, one car goes by, it's like a revelation, right? It's this whole thing
you
actually pay attention to. So that was really the point. And then I just tried to organize it and get points, kind of like what Pam was saying, actually, with some of the points.
Thank you.
So... yeah, yeah.
Great questions, guys. I mean, I always love Daniel hearing everybody's process. And the fact you're sitting here talking, and I imagine you walking down the street just commentating into your phone. And I think that's a really great way of capturing the spirit of the moment of whenever the muse hits you, you know. I really like that. Great insight.
25 years ago, I would look like I was insane. And now everybody walks down the street talking to themselves, so I can get away with it now.
Right, exactly.
Fair enough. Your next poem, The Future of Innocence Lost, is up and ready.
Excellent. Just getting that to come up here. The Future Past of Innocence Lost. Another day brings a simple walk down a simple street. Yet 100 yards away, I see into the future. I also see behind me the past. But it's before me that is blinding and fantastical. A few meters forward, I can forecast, but every step and the fog grows thick and the fractal paths multiply. get down the rabbit hole by goal, feeling more and more like I'm being pushed by the rabbit than chasing it. But either way, he is frantic and carries time around his neck. Innocent at any age are all to the madness that will come. And oh, how we all see with innocent eyes until the insanity throws away our own sense of real and until the wonderland we perceive is opioid smoke rings among sunset clouded skies. And through time is innocence lost, and through time is innocence regained. We are all experienced, and we are all children. And the future, just that rabbit hole, of which really contains no rabbit, a vortex of unknown. End poem.
You know, I just wasn't into Alice in Wonderland or Lewis and Carroll as a kid. But as I've grown older, every time someone uses that as an inspiration to their poetry, I fall in love with it. And I'm so inspired by the craziness of that whole story and what was created. And so I gain appreciation for that story. And then seeing poems like this that glean inspiration from it and then inspire me more to get into the whole story and the whole wonderment that is encaptured in that original inspiration. I think this one does an excellent job of that, Daniel. I mean, I was in the spirit when I read this for the first time a couple of days ago. I was off doing research on Alice in Wonderland because it inspired me that much. I got into the spirit of what you did here. Now, a theme, and you kind of touched on it, and this can be a throwaway question. If you don't want to get into this, feel free to just tell me to go take a hike. But I think what I see, a common theme in a lot of your work is you seem to be a very spiritual man. You seem to be someone that is always, not that you've found the answer, or if you have, you keep that private, and you inspire other people to look beyond. So I guess I'll keep it light in that how much does faith, spirituality, all of that play into your writing as inspiration?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm only going to tell you to go take a hike if it'll help you write, because that's how I would write taking a hike. So, yeah, you know, I was watching a show, Politically Incorrect, if you guys ever watched that a long time ago. It was a great show I liked where they have all these weird guests together and never be together. And there's one with a preacher on there that was just so full of hate. He was yelling at everybody and just interrupting everyone. And it just inspired me to say, religion can't be about that. It's just, there's no way it can be about that much hate. So I literally started reading the Bible and was just fascinated by it. I've read the Bible now cover to cover multiple times. I've read the Quran, the multiple Hindu texts, the Dhammapada, Bhagavad Gita, and all that stuff. And I just think they're all fascinating. So spirituality and all that is definitely something I've been into. I think everybody has some sort of spirituality in them. This one is kind of more about time, which I'm obsessed with. That was going to be my apology, but it doesn't look like we're going to get to a lot of the poems because I didn't realize till this morning when I was re-looking at my poems that there's like five of them on time. So I'm kind of glad we're not getting to all of them because they're all on some of the same thing. But this is my fascination with time because I really don't understand it from a deep, deep level. I don't know if anybody does. And it's just interesting to think of all the different ways that things can go and everything ahead of us and everything behind us, you know, that can happen with time. So I kind of took that aspect of it and applied it to, you know, the down the rabbit hole theory of Alice in Wonderland and, you know, the insanity of different things that can happen that you're not really sure what's going to happen with. And that's what every day is. Nobody really, you know, I know that someone's going to say something in a minute. Someone's going to ask me a question. Somebody's going to give a comment. I can forecast that time. I don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow, you know, and a year from now, who knows, you know. So the farther out you look, I mean, it's really hard to see the future. So it's kind of about that. But, yeah, philosophy is, you know, and spirituality, I think, all kind of go together.
Great answer, man. No, I like it. Thank I really you. Like it. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I liked that question that you had there, Jeremy, and wonderful answer there, Dan. I really like this all the way through. I have a real, as Jeremy said, appreciation for Alice in Wonderland, right? I think the thing with Alice in Wonderland is that as you become an adult and you grow and you process it, you realize the darkness and the craziness within the story. You see the things that you could not see with your child's eyes. And I like that you write about time. And, you know, I like that because it's such a fascinating thing. I did a dark show before on the fear of time. And time is a man-made invention. It's almost like we needed it. We needed that exact measurement of time in order to make our small egos feel secure. And this is wonderful all the way through, but I especially, like, get down the rabbit hole. I go finding more and more I'm being pushed by the rabbit than chasing it. But either way, he is frantic and carries time around his neck. There's to me that real weight of the end of life coming toward you. And I don't even remember why I thought this the first time I read this, but for some reason this spoke to me on the life of a soldier sacrificed into the unknown, and the war takes away innocence. I would like to know, my generic question is, besides the fact that you were extremely bored during lockdown, what else was it that got you into writing poetry?
Interesting question. And yes, I mean, soldiers going into war, that is definitely going down a rabbit hole, that's for sure. Neil Peart has been an influence of my life for a long time. I wrote, I forget the name of the poem now, but there's a poem on here about a tribute to him. And one day I remember exactly where I was sitting. I was so into the band Rush, and I loved their music. And one day I sat down and read the lyrics on the album Power Windows. I remember it was a cassette tape. I remember sitting there reading them and being like, wow, these are amazing. And I just started all of a sudden reading lyrics. I was probably, I don't know, 19 or 20 or something like that. And I really started actually looking into lyrics. And that part of that got me into philosophy and into more philosophical stuff instead of the novelizations I used to read more. Like I said before, I always tried to write, but I was always trying to write like form and trying to write, you know, how you're supposed to write. Okay, I need to write this meter, and I'm trying to copy other people, and it just didn't work. And then I just decided, you know, I would try once or twice a year, and it would come out and just be horrible. And then when the pandemic hit, I tried it again, and I don't even know what inspired me to do it. I just started to just, you know, close my, you know, let my mind clear and let it just come out, and it worked. And, you know, as far as inspiring me to do it again, I've always been trying to do it. I just couldn't find a way that worked for me until just happened to be during the pandemic. So never give up. Keep trying. Eventually it took me 30 years to figure out how to write poetry, but I finally figured out the way that worked for me. I would write, to be fair, I would write once and then try to write one poem and not write for 9 months, and then try again and hate it and give up for a year, you know. So it was like, you know, long periods of time in between, and now I write 2-3 a day.
Right on, man.
You got to keep writing, that's for sure. Even if you don't like what you've written, you got to keep at it day after day, I think.
I agree. Yeah, never give up. You're going to have bad, you know, everybody has bad days and stuff,
sure,
stuff you don't like, and you just got to keep going, you know. Absolutely.
Arliss, do you have any other commentary you want to provide to?
I liked talking about time, because time is so mysterious. It's evanescent. We can't grasp it. It's tied into our being, I think. But time really has only one dimension, I think. The future never comes. When it comes, it's today, so it's the present. The past is gone. It never comes back to the present except as memory. So all you have is the present. And yet we're obsessed with the future. We're always projecting out to it. We're looking backwards always to see where we've come from, what we've done right or wrong. But time is slippery. It slips away our conceptions, and it remains a big mystery right at the heart of our being. And I thought this poem really picked up on that and expressed it well. And I think what made it really work, is that instead of having this abstract discussion like I'm doing right now, you used imagery to exemplify the problem of time and how it's expressed differently. I mean, the idea of the rabbit hole we've already talked about, but that was very effective to, you know, get away from, philosophical generalities and really focus in on imagery. And imagery can carry a poem, I think, better than almost anything. So I thought this was very good, and I really enjoyed the philosophical angle to it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's some good Zen and Buddhist and even Jedi philosophy, right? Don't worry about the past. Nothing you can do about it. Future will be here. Live in the now.
Yeah, but it's always now. Exactly.
Great comments. Treadmill, what do you have to offer?
I really like this poem. I feel like it's like a really concise description of what it's like to be conscious and be able to think into the future and try and plan, but then to be like pushed by the rabbit or to not be able to really control your future. Does that make any sense? Like,
yeah. Well, no, it does. Definitely, it's hard to.
Like, it's a strange cognition that we can actually even think into the future.
It is. We can conceptualize it, you know, but you don't have control over your past, right? Because you can't do anything about it. It's already happened. You can't change the past, right? But then the future, you try to be proactive, but we're all reactive people because we have to be because things change. So it's one of the only selfish things I do when I write poetry is the time ones, because I'm literally just trying to figure it out in my head to see if I can understand it a little better. So I just kind of think out loud, and it's a very hard concept that I still struggle with.
I kind of think of it as the psychological concept of like heuristics and biases. So we can think about our future, we can plan, but then there's all these outside triggers and environments, and then our innate blindnesses that distract us that we can know about, but that we can never change.
Yeah, and that's the fractal path I talk about there. I think about it sometimes when I am walking, like literally, do I go down this street or this street? Because that's two different now futures that I'm going to have. Even though I'll probably just go down there and end up home, but it's completely different futures. So which one do I go down? And there's, you know, thousands of those different fractal paths that you take every day. And, makes me very sleepy thinking about that. It's too much for my little mind.
I appreciate you offering so much. We're going to try to shoehorn one more in before we let you go. It is on the boards when you're ready.
Puppet, this is called. Yeah, we'll get one more in here. So this is another one about time called Puppet. I always felt myself a time traveler, a relic from the past, an arrow shot into the future, a raft afloat in an oscillating sea of hours. But beliefs, as usual, create the fool who believes in them. I am a mere puppet in the theater of time. I speak, and it is gone. Each word, each thought, destroyed and lost, sent hurling into the abyss of forgotten moments. I think, or do I? I see more a vessel, a gully, a valley in which the waters of time flow, dragging the dirt and silt of which it passes over, which buries me in thoughts and memories. I can't stop it. I can't repeat it. I can only beg for its mercy. Stars are born, light the heavens, and when time says enough, they are gas and dust that float in the nothing. What am I among the stars? Only but dust from their dust at the whim of time. End poem.
Great read. Pam, you want to kick us off?
Absolutely. This write is amazing. I thought it had brilliant imagery and metaphors. It was powerful. I like how this one touches on, as you were talking about before, the idea that we have no control over time. I am a mere puppet in the theater of time. I speak and it is gone. Each word, each thought destroyed and lost are probably my favorite lines. But I also like, I always am a big fan of when people bring the, you know, the stars, the heavens, the planets into a right. Stars are born and light the heavens, and when time is enough, they are gas and dust that float in the nothing. That idea that even some of the most beautiful and powerful things we see out there are our own, are so temporary. So beautifully written and very well done.
Thank you, Pam.
Arliss, what do you have to offer?
I like this poem as well. It was very meditative. It seemed very existential, especially the ending. You know, everything is dissolving into nothing. So I think, where's the hope? But maybe you're not intending to convey hope in this poem. I like the elemental approach to this that really made it shine, I thought. But the negative imagery was very strong, and it did lead to this finale of, I guess, nothingness, if you want to put it that way. And that's always strong. If you contemplate that, you won't need any sleep because you'll be up all night trying to figure it out. So, very good job. I like this one a lot.
Thank you, my friend.
You're welcome.
Great comments. Sucker for the treadmill, what do you have to offer?
I like the idea of like an empty vessel moving into nothingness, but also described in a way that sort of presents that they understand things. Like there's something comforting in the knowledge that you can't stop or that you can't repeat it, or that you can only like beg for mercy when you're thinking about big events like the stars and star death that are beyond our capabilities to understand in the sense of time. Like we know stars die because we see them, but we're never going to see a star from life to birth.
Absolutely, like, my friends.
It's almost like just letting yourself go into it, like, you know, and it's okay.
Yep, ride the wave.
But beliefs, as usual, create the fool who believes in them. I love that little snippet in the second. I mean, that really carries the weight of puppet for me, and I love that word. I've always loved that word, puppet. But that little snippet in the second kind of created it all, and I really like how that carries the theme. Daniel, I'm not going to hit you with any more heavy questions. You have spurred some incredible conversation. It has been a pleasure interviewing you, having you headline for us. I'm inspired by your poetry. I can't wait to read more. I can't wait to see your book that's about to come out. Please do post it and let us all know. We only made it through only four or five of your poems in your set list, so I encourage everyone to check out Daniel DeShino's poetry here on All Poetry. He has some other outlets as well. So it's been a pleasure, my friend. Thank you for spending the time. Thank you for staying up late tonight with us.
Absolutely, I appreciate it. And Arliss, my apologies. I'll stick around as long as I can, but time is hitting these old bones, and I might have to leave. But I'll stick around as long as I can.
Problem.
So my apologies
no problem.
To you. But
life
thank you, everybody.
Happens.
It was
all right.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very honor and humbling to be with all of you great poets, and I really appreciate the time and being invited on the show. So thank you very much. And Arliss, the show is yours.
Oh, right, okay.
Right. Your first poem, Arliss, is up and ready to recite when you are. Kind of blue.
Okay. I told Jeremy that I am going to do this the old-fashioned way, the tactile way, and hold the paper printout of my poem and read it from there. But you're welcome, obviously, to follow along. I'll just make my plug early. I have a new book out. It just came out a couple of weeks ago called Kind of Blue. this first poem is the title poem for the book. And I like numbered sections in my poem, so be prepared for the numbers being barked out. All right, Kind of Blue. One, the promise of creativity flows like rain pebbling the roof of the study where your untidy poems lie. A glance backward sweeps the world as rotund as an orange, as blue as the books we pack in the refrigerator boxes. A deep cyan, dark as night, settles over the city. Indigo streets, limbed avenues, dreams encased in dreams. Two. Waters wash over me, a placid azure stitched with maroon and gray. I marvel at them in autumn on the streets of Scotland. Blood-red moon ascending over Edinburgh's castle. Black sky, the fingerprints of God pressed onto burned-out suns, novas, nuevas, Namur. I would tally the containers, but the abacus is broken. All numbers equal 9. Aquamarine brings green to bear on the equation. 3. Salt seeps through the hollows of the walls. The room interrogates itself in pools of seaweed, soft-shelled crabs, angular gulls. You know the ocean's rhyme, but the meter is skewed, the skewer heavy with charboiled fish, no plates, forks. Sea reflects sky, reflects sea, reflects a kind of blue, exonerates my mood. Trumpet trills shrink the shallow hue of veins. Blood pumps blue, pumps red, pumps life on the cathedral steps. Oh, negative breaks positive. I will sweep up the pieces. Paint them steely blue. End poem.
Wonderful read. Daniel, I'll let you go first while we still got you.
Sure. I thought this was absolutely beautiful. And, you know, I love the reflection of just the color blue and the different ways that it can – you can interpret it within your life. And I actually am going to – just jump into questions because I have a couple of questions here, if it's okay to ask two. First one is the line, all numbers equal 9. I would love your thoughts on your writing on that. And also why you did the 1, 2, 3. I've done writing like that before. I did a little bit tonight and why you decided to go that way, because I think it's very interesting. I think it works beautifully here.
Well, I'll answer the second question first. Because I'll probably have to stumble to give you an answer on the first one. I like numbered sections because I like to use a lot of imagery, and imagery is suggestive, it's associative, and therefore it doesn't have to flow linearly throughout the whole poem. So you set off a section, develop it, hopefully the imagery is strong. You go to the next section and continue that. It just depends on the strength of the imagery and whether these sections can essentially stand alone. And I think they do, but you know, that's it's always up to the reader to decide whether a poem works or what it means. All numbers equal 9. Well, we know 9 is a magic number in many ways. You can investigate how it's used throughout mathematics and arithmetic. I just wanted to give a kind of a surreal feel to this. I mean, the imagery is somewhat natural, but it's used in a way that's a little unconventional. And all numbers equal 9 is just another motif of that somewhat surreal imagery. So those are my answers, for better or worse.
No, excellent. That helped me, and that was my favorite line. It was all numbers equal 9, so thank you very much for those answers.
Sure, thank you.
And don't worry, Alex, there are no wrong answers to this show, so you answer however you'd like. It was wonderful. Treadmill, how would you like to comment?
Sorry, did you say me?
Yes, I did.
Hey, yeah, I just have a couple of questions as well. Did you have, like,
sure,
a narrative in mind? Or is this like a like an expression of melancholy and you're just kind of going for it? Or did you have like a theme thought out already before you wrote? And were you listening to Miles Davis when you wrote it?
Well, no, not when I wrote this, but I was listening to him a lot before I put my book together. And obviously the title is taken from his famous album that really changed the face of jazz in the 1950s, and his influence continues today, for that matter. No, there's no narrative here, really. It's like I said, the logic of this is associative, making connections, you know, juxtapositions, putting things against each other and see how they play out. I wanted, obviously, to riff on blue because that's the whole theme of my book. So no narrative, not really telling a story, but just different expressions of blue in these three sections.
Thank
did
you.
That answer
really
your questions
like
or not?
Yeah, it definitely did. And
okay,
good. I think that the tone is really jazzy. I really like it.
Good, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I want to second that because after reading your body of work, I know that your moniker is Arliss D, but I made your name a verb as I have been Arlissed after I read your poem because it takes me on such a journey. It takes me on such a mental journey, and it's kind of a serendipitous pairing that you have tonight because in going through Daniel's stuff earlier and a lot of his explanations and a lot of the stuff that I was feeling in your poem, Arliss, your poems, your body of work tonight, I'm seeing a lot of similarities. There's so much in this that sent my mind reeling, that sent me off daydreaming. I think it was a comment I made earlier. And I think that's a mark. I asked Pam this question last week, which he considers to be a mark of good poetry. And I think something that we talked about earlier about connecting with the reader is very important, but also poetry that inspires. I mean, in reading a poem like this, there's so many nuggets that get me inspired and make me daydream that I have to make 4, 5, 10 passes to soak it all in because my brain is shooting off on tangents all the time. I really love, I would tally the containers, but the abacus is broken. And then your explanation and what Daniel picked up on, that all numbers equal 9. And then the facts of what Treadmill said, the fact that this has a Miles Davis, a jazzy underfeel, I think all of that is true. And in reading this the first time, all the colors that you brought to this poem were almost that background noise, were almost that bebop in the walkthrough, the experiencing of all of these things that you're saying. It's almost like the colors are just the background noise of the journey that this poem took me on. So, I mean, my initial question was the chapter format that you have, so it's already been asked and answered. So with that, I'm going to pass it along to Pam, but I very much enjoyed this. This is a great write.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that too.
Absolutely. This is a wonderful, wonderful write. I've actually am a big fan of your poetry, Arliss, and your use of creative imagery and metaphors. I like that this is, to me, a quiet, meditative celebration of colors, and especially the color blue. And I like this all the way through, but what really speaks to me is the third part, which starts with salt seeps through the hollows of walls, the room interrogates itself in pools of seaweed. You know, all the way through, you've got wonderful imagery, but I will say that, and I've said this before, so forgive anybody who's heard me say this, is I love when people bring salt into poetry. Salt is a natural antibiotic. It is used to preserve food. I mean, there is so much about salt that it represents, you know, life and balance and makes for, to me, such a wonderful metaphor for, you know, preserving the beauty of life, you know, and just a wonderful write. And I'm going to skip a question and come up with one in the next couple of writes. So, but
okay. Well, thank you. Thank you.
We are ready, Arliss, when you are with your next poem.
Okay. It's Zabriskie Point. Is that correct? I'm looking at my paper copies here. I just want to make sure I got the right poem. Okay. Does anybody know where Zabriskie Point is?
Death
Any
Valley.
Idea?
Let me look it up.
Yeah, it's Death Valley National Park. It's a beautiful spot in Death Valley where you get a vista, panoramic vista of the desert beauty of that place, which I really like. So this was inspired by standing on Zabriskie Point earlier this year. One, the mind replenishes itself in stark pirouettes of light. Body kisses soul, the inrush of blood, tingling desire, the broken mirror of touch. Oh, how eternal union eludes us. Oh, how the night sweeps up pieces of dawn, scatters them like stones from a cairn toppled in the wind. Two, fleur de lis, fleur du mal, hammer the cymbal to cling like a gong, hammer the hearer to echo like a gorge, life, knife, strife, immortality swoons at the grave of a blue moon. Ask for excess, more than you could want. Ask for redemption from being unto death. Throw yourself back into the world. Urge the other to shepherd what is. Urge the other to shadow what is not. Urge the other to care for the great mystery. End poem.
Wonderful read. Wonderful read. Sucker for the treadmill, start us off, please.
Okay. I feel like, as opposed to Jeremy, that our list is sort of getting more concretely into like nature, and saying a lot of the same things, but sort of like in a way that doesn't like throw it out into the philosophical void, but brings it down to earth and the self and the body. This poem to me is really inspiring. It feels like how I would like to be, how I'd like to look at life. Like the last stanza, I think, is a really beautiful philosophy in quotes on, or an outlook.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think I know you're praising the poem, so I'm not going to say you're perceptive about praise, but I think you've hit on something about the last section. So I am glad to get that insight from you.
Great comments. I really love hammer the hear to echo like a gorge, life, knife, strife. I really love how it's onomatopoeic. I love how it just works so well, and I felt like I was there. I've only been to the Death Valley one time. It was in the summertime, and it was on a motorcycle.
And you almost
so
died,
damn
right?
Hot. Yeah, I couldn't get there fast enough. So, I mean, obviously it was a special place for you. I mean, like I said, I didn't know anything about the Zabriskie Point until I read this poem and had to learn a little bit more about it. But can you elaborate on what this trip was for you, what this moment was for you? I mean, I know that you do it in the poem, but also can you just give me some more real-life experience on what it was like being there and why it inspired you to write?
Well, Death Valley is the desert environment, and deserts can often seem empty and void of life, certainly, you know, animal life, some plant life. But the thing about Death Valley is it's set in this desert setting. But the rock formations, the canyons, the mountains that ring the park, they all are just exquisitely beautiful. And if you have the right eyes to see, you can just really appreciate the wonder and variety and force of nature that's expressed in these stones. It's just it can be sort of ecstatic and take you out of yourself. And Zabriskie Point does that, even though you're surrounded by hundreds of tourists. I mean, you never have the place alone, but it really transports you. And that's what I look for in travel, and that's what I try to get across in my poems as well. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes not, but I think the language of poetry can really take you out of yourself. Where it takes you into, you know, that's an open question. But that sense of being transported is really fundamental to what I try to do with poetry.
Like a sense of awe, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
I was asking if you mean like a sense of awe.
A like sense of awe,
stars,
sure,
sort
exactly.
Of.
Yeah, the formations in Death Valley will trigger that if you're open to it. I mean, you have to approach it with kind of the right mindset and not just take a selfie in front of Zabriskie Point and get back in your van and drive to the next attraction so you can get out of the park. Yeah, you have to be open to it, but it's so rewarding.
Yeah, and I love how you described that. I just wrote that down. The language of poetry can take you out of yourself. I really like that explanation. Pam, what
good.
Do you think?
Yeah, this is beautifully written. I really like how there's a wonderful sense of sound and movement within this poem, especially at the end of that first part and going into the second part. And I have noticed that a lot of your poetry uses nature as inspiration, or at least as imagery and metaphors. And also sometimes I noticed that you seem to delve into touches of being inspired by history. And I'd like to know what else inspires you to write poetry?
Okay, that's a big question. We could be here all night. I tell you, I've been writing, I mean, I think I'm older than any of you there, but I've been writing poems for 50 years, 50. And I started out, like most poets, with self-expression, trying to, you know, organize yourself on a page, which is very hard to do and is not a very good use of poetry, in my opinion. Now I'm looking at metaphor and imagery, and you can find that anywhere, again, if you're open and sensitive and looking. You can find it in nature. I mean, a big fan of nature, as you said. But what you find in nature, along with power, like you find in Death Valley, is beauty, and there's extraordinary beauty throughout all of nature, and that's very inspiring. Plus, so many poets that I have read, inspire me to write, and there are too many to name, but W.S. Merwin, an American poet, died not too long ago, is one of my favorites, and he's very much intertwined with nature and his poetry. So there are a lot of sources. I kind of pursue the muse the way was talked about before, where you just sit and wait and something comes to you and then you take that and run with it. Of course, I try to make my poems complex with layers. But I'm always open to a new inspiration, a new vision, a new sensation, really. That's probably a long answer to your question.
No, that was a
Not
great answer.
Not at all. Wonderful answer. Daniel, are you still with us?
I am, yeah. I wanted to get one more poem in before I left. So I read both of these before, and I really enjoyed this one a lot. And what I liked about it, Arliss, was It was a great description of this place, but you really got the sense of what you felt when you were there, and I think that is some of the beauty of poetry. You know, it's there's the philosophy or the old saying of, you know, you can read whatever you want in a book, but, you know, I think they mentioned it in the movie Good Will Hunting, you know, paraphrasing, but he said, you know, you can tell me all about the Sistine Chapel, but you can't tell me what it feels like to be there and look up at it. And so I think,
right, exactly.
You know, I think that's what you captured was what I like the most about this, is that the, not only what happened, the descriptions of what was there, but how you felt and what it made you feel while you were there. And that's that's something that you can't really know until you are there. So I thought that was great. My other point, and I have a quick question for you, is that I think one of the signs of a great poet to me is, or a great artist, is that you can tell it's them. You know, B.B. King always comes to mind. B.B. King can play one note on the guitar, you know it's him. For me, Billy Cobham, the drummer, he can play, you know, it's hard to tell who a drummer is, but I know it's Billy almost instantly. And so I think, you know, I'm starting to see what's you. I can kind of see that now. You have a style, you have a way of seeing. So I could see me reading a poem and say, it sounds like that kind of sounds like an Arliss poem. So I think that's great. I can see that. I can see that in you. My question is one of the same ones you asked me. I'm interested in your method and how you do write. It seems like you're using paper and pen, which I'm jealous. I wish I could. I get too bored. My writing is atrocious. I can't even read it. So I'm wondering if you do use paper and pen, if it's kind of medicinal almost for you, like therapeutic to get that on the paper, if that's what you use and what your method is.
Well, I do write everything out longhand, pen and paper. It's therapeutic is not quite the word that I would use, but I'm convinced, that's why I like to hold these hard copies of the poems when I read them. I'm convinced that making poetry tactile enhances its capabilities of expression and really of thought too. That kind of goes down a rabbit hole of its own, but when you write holding a pen on a piece of paper, the words that you write essentially travel up your hand, you know, toward your heart and your brain, and there's a real sense, a literal sense of touch that carries your words. And so by doing that, it just builds from thought to thought or stanza to stanza, and I keep writing, keep scribbling, keep marking out. But always try to put it down pen to paper. I mean, sometimes I admit I have to write on my laptop because I just don't have time to find something to write with. But most of the time, my method is to use pen and paper.
Hey, man, that's the Beethoven way, you know. He scratches and crosses all over the place, and then he had that masterpiece. So, excellent,
right,
excellent.
Exactly.
Great question. Great answer. I love it. We're ready for the next one, Arliss, when you are. Orion.
Okay. This is inspired by a poem by William Stafford. He's a Kansas poet where I live, Kansas, and a well-known poet. He wrote a beautiful poem about running into a deer on the highway and what he had, the moral dilemma he faced. About life and death with the deer. So this is inspired by his poem. It's called Orion, after William Stafford. The doe, long gone cold, looked weirdly back at me, her neck broken, her eye frozen in a wall-eyed stare from the pit of death. Her tawny hide bleached gray flecks of fur. She had bartered her beauty for one last leap across the old wire fence. Yesterday, the hunters came. Startled on my way back to the car, I saw her hind legs strangled in the top wire of fencing, some farmer's pledge to stay a good neighbor. My shadow loped ahead of me in the glow of a sleepy-eyed sun. I was thinking how the river would wash away the blood from my hands. I was thinking about Faust and his folly. at the car, I looked back, the deer's eye black as sin. Now she would no longer search the night sky for the pointed tip of Orion's arrow. Now she no longer shivered in the winter winds. Behind me, two guns fired. End of poem.
I really dig this one on a lot of levels. I mean, I really dig it on a lot of levels. I like the distance it traveled in the end for me on this one, because I wasn't realizing it was as much about hitting with the car, believe it or not. I thought it was more about hunting and mercy and all
that. Oh, this poem is about hunting. I'm saying Stafford's poem is about hitting a deer with a car.
I got you. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
So, yes, it did. That's what I thought. I thought it was more about hunting, and I like that. And I liked the moral dilemma of it. And then when it gets into she would no longer search the night for the pointed tip of Orion's arrow, I mean, that's so beautiful, but there's so much wonderment on that. There's so much innocence on that, and it's the robbing. That in itself is the whole dilemma. I mean, that is the beauty of all of it, that of the dilemma of whether to kill or not to kill for whatever reason, for sport, for food, for whatever. And then behind me, two guns fired, saying that you weren't there for that moment, that awful moment. It's behind you. It's something – I don't know. This poem travels a long way, and I really, really enjoyed what you did. And the fact that it was inspired by another poet is encouraging to me, because I like when someone else's creativity breeds creativity, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So
right.
I really enjoyed it for those aspects. I mean, I think it goes a long way in a storied format. My question for you is, being that you had mentioned that you've been in the game for many years, what advice would you give?
Right.
What lessons would you give other poets?
Well, here's my first lesson. Don't give up. Keep at it. But I have a maxim, I guess, I would say, that if you want to write well, you need to read well. If you want to be a good poet, if you want to be a great poet, you need to read other poets and poets who are accomplished and good at the game and who know how to use poetic devices and who know how to create expressions of emotion or vision or insight that stir you. So if you want to write well, read well. And I've come a long way from self-expression, thankfully. But now in my old age, I'm thinking voice is one of the most important things, and I'm really trying to focus on that now. And the other thing is just to, I've used this word a lot, but you have to remain open to what's coming to you. There's always something coming to you, and if you're open to it, you can capture it in words, get it on paper or on your screen, and make something artistic and significant and maybe lasting. You know, we never know if it's going to last or not, but being open to what comes toward you is really the key, I think.
I love that answer, Alice. I think it's great, being open and be aware of what's going around, because there's always poetry amiss. Yeah, I like that.
Right.
Great comment. Pam, what are your thoughts?
Thank you.
Yeah, an amazing write that captures the death, and almost like, I don't know if beauty is the right word, but, you know, well, for lack of a better word, I'll just say that this takes the confrontation of death and makes it beautiful. And I really like it all the way through, but especially you have really down-to-earth and real imagery, and to me, in that stanza that starts with, "Startled on my way back to the car, I saw her hind leg strangled in the top wire of fencing, some farmer's pledge to stay a good neighbor." I guess my question would be, so tell us a little bit about your writing process. Like, Do you hold your poems in drafts for quite a while? Do you do a lot of editing, or do you usually find that it just comes out right in the first draft or two?
That's a good question. A little difficult for me to answer. Things come to me. I'll put it that way. You can talk about a muse if you want. Things come to me, images usually, sometimes ideas. And I just have to get that down on paper first. And that's like the foundation. That's the starting point. You may get rid of it by the time you finish the poem. It may not work any longer, but getting that first thought down is really essential for me writing my poems. And then I just try, I mean, this sounds cliche, really, but I just try to listen to what I've written down and then draw associations from that. I really think imagery and metaphor are the strengths of poetry. Now I'm trying to add voice to that and really develop a strong voice in what I'm writing now. The things I write now, I write very fast. For a while there, I wrote a poem a day, and I would have it finished in a day, not just the draft, but the finished poem. I'm not quite doing that right now, but I used to spend a lot of time rewriting. Now I try to get it down in a final form, you know, when I first start out. So that's some of the difference I've gone through in my career as a poet.
Wonderful insight.
Cool.
Yeah, I like that. Sucker for the treadmill. What do you have to add?
I like this poem. That's really helpful for me. I didn't have advance notice or didn't have the time, but to me, it reads like a comparison of hunting or hitting a deer with your car. And then the type of struggle you deal with if you're trying to reconcile either one. It's like you have to do bad things to survive, and the flow of time will wash it away, or the river. But I didn't really understand the Orion reference, but like you said, it was a really beautiful expression, how the doe would no longer search the night sky for the pointed tip of Orion's arrow. It's like a beautiful death. Sometimes you have to do it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, I also really appreciated the comments, the explicit comment on self-expression. No one has ever mentioned that to me explicitly, so it's really good to hear because I know I do it. And you mentioned earlier trying to put yourself onto the paper and how you don't think that's a very good expression of poetry. And I totally agree, but I needed to hear it from somebody who writes good poetry to, I think, give me the extra shove to try and just not do that.
Well, I don't want to come down too hard. It has its place. I mean, it had its place for me when I was 19 or so. Now that I'm much older, when I read it, other poems that are about that, they don't do anything for me. So I've just moved on from that. But it doesn't mean it's not legitimate. Everybody starts out doing it, you know, because yourself is an anomaly and you can't get it figured out. You have to put it on paper and work through it. But I think it's a stage that you can get past at some point if you continue to write poems.
It's almost like what's it called? Like if you have a fear of snakes and you go to a therapist, habituation theory.
Right.
Like where you put yourself in front of it over and over and over, and then it doesn't hurt you anymore.
It doesn't hurt you anymore.
Something stupid. Yeah.
Wonderful conversation, guys. Hey, Arliss, I want to make sure that you do get to emphasize your book or any other places we can find your poems beyond All Poetry before we get too deep.
Okay,
so you do have...
sure. I just published Kind of Blue. I talked about that. My publisher is Meadowlark Books. And if you're interested in my work, I mean, I'm not plugging my books for you, but if you're interested in buying a book, I really ask that you go to MeadowlarkBooks.com rather than go to Amazon, where you'll find all my books. But it's an independent publisher. They work hard. They're very savvy about publishing and poetry. They need to be rewarded with sales, in my opinion. So it's metalark-books.com.
Absolutely.
I have three books.
Okay.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was interrupting you. Go right ahead. This is what I'm looking for. Go for it.
I have three books. The first was is titled Setting the Waves on Fire. The second, which came out last year, is called Everlasting. And then the third came out just a week or two ago. It's called Kind of Blue. They're all published by Meadowlark. They're all fine quality books. And if you're interested, I would just encourage you to go to the source rather than to the big box online that sucks up the little stores and then undercuts their prices like crazy. So I'll make a plug for my publisher. And if you're interested, you can check out my books. I've got them listed on my homepage on All Poetry, so you can take a look at them there if you're interested.
Absolutely. No, plug away. That's what this is all about.
Well, it means something to have a book published, and it's a good encourager to keep at it. So I am always grateful whenever the publisher says yes and sends me a contract. But, I don't expect it to happen every time. So.
Very cool. Well, congratulations for your success in publishing. And, I'm inspired to check out your books, and I hope others are as well. Meadowlark Publishing, you say?
Meadowlark-books.com, okay. Yeah.
Right on. Check them out.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Your next poem, while we have you, The Kingfisher, has been posted.
The Kingfisher. All right. The epigraph to this poem is from Gerard Manley Hopkins. He's an English poet that I think everyone should read because his use of language is just phenomenal, just fantastic. Poem about the kingfisher. This reads, as kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. Here in the great marsh of solitude, where each step sucks up a sludge of mud and withering reeds, I search for the kingfisher, who spears his prey with the speed of light, swallows it whole, and clown walks through waves that lap his anorexic knees. Hopkins sets the bird on fire, iridescently burning through his unmanacled poem. Immanence and transcendence meld like bronze and steel. Creation, one glorious feat, one marvelous miracle splashing apart beyond our imagination. With the kingfisher we cry, what I do is me, for that I came. I have slogged my way through muck, undeterred by slow progress, undefeated by the path alone, the path without end, the path of unrequited promise. No companion darkens my way. No mind nurtures my own. Trailing the kingfisher, I trudge and slosh. Selves go itself. Myself it speaks and spells. End of poem.
Great read. Great read. Pam, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, absolutely. An amazing write all the way through. I really like that you use the kingfisher and the movement of the kingfisher as an extended metaphor. And I particularly like that last stanza, I have staggered my way through muck, undeterred by slow progress, undefeated by the path alone. You know, to me, the movement of the kingfisher in those moments, you know, represents that person who refuses to be defeated, even through those difficult times in life when you feel like that muck of life is just pulling you down. You keep moving forward. And so to me, there's a within those lines, a real sense of hope. And so this was very well done.
Thank you. I appreciate that, too. I never really thought about it being an expression of hope, but I can see how that would come across as well. So that's refreshing. That's what I mean. The reader makes the meaning. It's not just the poet's intention. So thank you for that, Pam.
Absolutely.
Great comments. Great comments, Pam. Sucker for the Treadmill, what do you have to offer?
I read it kind of like Pam as a inspirational almost. I really like in the first stanza how in the first lines, like it's talking about moving through a marsh and how when you put your feet in the mud, it creates this little suction thingy. And it made me think that he was talking about the kingfisher, and then instantly he goes into searching for the kingfisher, which I thought was cool. Like it's already a part of him, or he already has it. And then he talks about, the way I read it at least, I don't understand the Hopkins reference, but it sounded maybe like, I don't know, I guess I can't comment on that. But it seems like, to me, the second stanza reads like a transformation, a new insight or knowledge that creates a new tool. And then the third stanza to me reads like, if you are the kingfisher, you can sort of ignore the muck, you know, the muck of life, the muck of thinking, and do your task, do the hunt or whatever, do the dive for the fish.
That's a good analysis. I enjoyed that. I think you're onto something there, too. Hopkins, like I said, is a poet that really should be read. He's difficult, but it's worthwhile, I think. So.
Great. I'll definitely check him out. Thank you.
Sure. And what was really cool, what was really neat about the progression between this one and the one we just read is that it's from the other end of the spectrum. The last poem that we just read, there was beauty found and love and compassion for the prey. And in this one, you're trying to be the predator. You want to be, and there's a desire to even keep up with this predator in his art. And it could have, and I really like what both Pam and Sucker for the Treadmill said on this poem, because I think they were spot on. A lot of the feeling I felt as well. And you could have used any bird that hunts for fish. You could have said lark. This could have been anything. But the fact that it's the kingfisher really took this to a different level to me. It made it more elegant, apex. It made it more exacting. It added a sharpness to it. And the fact that every time that the voice, the narrative voice in this poem is trudged down and can't keep up, can't aspire, can't come close, has a hard time even keeping pace with that exactedness, that sharpness, that aggressive, again, the predator feel. And there's nothing but admiration for that. I mean, it's cool that there's, again, this compared to the poem we just read, there's that comparison. So I very much enjoyed it, and I very much enjoyed the previous comments. So my question for
you
is, throughout your process, you've talked about it. What about those downtimes? What about those times when you really feel like you should be writing? You said you used to produce almost a poem a day, or you did do a poem a day, and you might not be at that pace now. But are there times when you run up against the dreaded writer's block? How do you coax your way or motivate your way back through that?
Well, That's a good question. That's a question every poet should consider. I used to have true writer's block, and that was kind of a depressing time, and you kind of come to doubt yourself. Do you really have a gift or a talent or not? Are you just playing at this, or are you really creating something? But I don't have that now. I try to discipline myself to write, you know, all the time. The last 2 weeks have been really busy for me, so I haven't been able to write very many poems. But I just find that, you know, reading, thumbing through an anthology, coming across a vivid poem by some author I don't know, there might be an image there or a hook or an idea or feeling that you can play off of and try to make it your own to begin with. And then hope that you can shape something out of it. But I don't really run into writer's block anymore. I just say, well, I've got to write something, and I'm determined to do it. And it may not be great. It may never get in a book, of course. But I try to keep at it every day. If you do run into writer's block, you just can't give up. The secret is never give up. And keep at it, because if you have the gift, it repays you in innumerable ways, and you don't want to give that up because it's so rich for you personally. So that's my non-answer, I guess, to your question.
No, that's an excellent answer. Excellent answer, Alice. I really appreciate those words. I love that. Let's get one more in before we have to close for the evening. So your last poem, Heavy as Stone, has been posted. It is ready for you.
Okay. You'll see numbered sections here as well, only two of them, so you don't have to endure too much. Heavy as Stone. One, footholds on the wall fill in like skittish skull prints at low tide. All form vanishes into liquid. All liquid cements into form. I have climbed over stones larger than the world. I have cradled egos in crooks of trees. I have brushed against the void before crumbling into dust. Fluorescent meadows feed throngs of cattle and sheep. Bells punctuate the air with an abstract melody. Soon birds will echo it as they mate. Two. I have built altars unknown to the wind. I have recorded voices of angels in my sleep. Fear not. Abandon yourself to the road still taken. Cultivate simplicity. Harvest joy. The wall divides this life from the next. Its footholds have vanished. Waters wash over the surface like mountain streams. I catapult into the future, boxing solid air. Starlings flutter, lie dead on the road. The sky will not buoy them. The earth claims its own. There is no joy on the mountain, only simplicity. I carry it away, heavy as stone. End poem.
Wonderful read, Alice. Sucker for the treadmill, would you like to start us off, please?
Right away, it reminded me of the first time I tried to write a poem. And I tried to write it about, I was like lonely or something, and I tried to write it about like four blank walls, like being in a white room with four walls. And I really liked how he talks about footholds on the wall and brings in animal life and the ocean and talking about how that sort of disperses into the ocean or the earth. And for some reason, cement really connects with me. Like it's like a tool, an invention, or something that really sticks to you that you have after that. And then it almost seems like the other one, like a process of thinking or like stages of thinking. It's his view of the world, and it's really calming to read, and it's inspirational. I don't know, like have brushed against the void before crumbling into dust. Sounds like something sad. Or fluorescent meadows feed throngs. It's kind of like super creative, almost trippy, or really bright. And then talking about altars, unknown to the wind, it's like your own little, your house, your poetic house. I guess I'm just, I feel like he's writing about thinking or writing about writing poetry. So I guess I'm trying to get better at not just ranting and asking questions. Is this a poem about your house, your poetry, your writing, or your thinking?
Well, that's a tricky question. It's about thinking, and it's about observing. The fluorescent meadows come straight from Switzerland when I was there with my wife 3 years ago, and I live in Kansas, so it's landlocked, but I've been to the ocean many times all around the world, and I'm always fascinated by ocean life, and I just use that often as to get a sense of nature, but also the sense that things are swept away, the tide comes in, the gull prints vanish when the tide goes out, things of that sort. This is really about whether you find joy and simplicity. That's really my point, whether you do or not. The speaker, it's not necessarily me, comes across saying, you know, I carry it away, but it's like a burden. It's heavy as stone. It weighs me down. But simplicity is supposed to have the opposite effect, freeing, liberating, making things easier, clearer, and so forth. So I try to play up that contrast. Is it about my house? No, it's about the house in my head, really. Would I live by the ocean? I'd love to, but fate has put me elsewhere. So it's more about the struggle for hope and being settled and determining whether simplicity is really what it's cracked up to be.
Can I ask what you mean by simplicity, like simple living?
Yeah, simplicity is like, you know, cutting down the material side of your life to the bare minimum, sort of having an ordered, relatively slow pace where you focus deeply on a few maybe perhaps mundane things, and it's not driven by ambition or a sense to accomplish, but it's basically just being attuned to
kind of like monastic living?
Yeah, monastic living is an excellent example of it. You got it, absolutely.
Great comments and questions, guys. I really like that conversation. I enjoyed this one, Alice. I mean, I've enjoyed all your contributions tonight, this one especially. And there was an extra inflection in your voice when you read this one. I found this is a very inspirational write. And I was beating my chest a little bit while you were reading this because there was a lot of power and there was a lot of inspiration in it, but it wasn't over the top. I mean, you do it with a beautiful poetic pen. So it took I allowed my mind to go that way during this read. It didn't go to that extreme when I passed on my own during my own time before. But during this read, I was really kind of letting your words and everything that I've gleaned from you and your history and your process and your comments tonight, I've let all that kind of soak in and apply to this poem. And it really became very inspirational to me. I especially liked the nods. There's a couple subtle nods. I think there's a frost nod in there a little bit. And then there's the heaviest of stone was almost a mythological atlas reference to a degree. And so I really appreciate all of that, where throughout your poetry you've gleaned from other, there's been other creative influences that you pay homage to. You've gone to other languages. You've gone to other great thinkers. And it really comes through. And all the advice that you've given us tonight that you need to read, you need to immerse yourself in the craft and never give up. I mean, all of that is felt through me in this poem tonight. So I'm glad. I'm sad to see that we're ending, but I'm glad it was on this poem. It all came to a crescendo for me on this one. So, well done. And I'll let Pam. Pam,
thank you very much. I appreciate that too.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll let Pam close out the comments tonight.
Absolutely, that wonderful, right? I have to agree with Jeremy. I like the advice that you had to give, especially the one on not giving up and, you know, constantly be reading. And, I like how the first part of this where you say all forms vanishes into liquid, all liquid cements into form, gives a nod to science. You know, I think oftentimes as poets, we become obsessed with art, with imagination, which is a beautiful thing, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But I think there's this way of interweaving science and art, and within those lines, you do that wonderfully. I will say that of all this poem, this whole entire poem, the one line that really grabbed my attention was, I catapult into the future fighting solid air, because there's such a duality to that. There's the idea, like, it made me think of basket cabin during your dream, like during dreams. But it also made me think about how we always have to think about the future. Like when we're standing somewhere and we're contemplating our life in that moment, we have to look to say, okay, like you were talking about, you know, the idea of living a life of simplicity, and you're, you know, thinking about that. But then you have to think, okay, if I live this life in simplicity, what does that mean to my future? And so I guess my question is simply this, if you would offer up a short understanding for me of, if possible, of what you were thinking when you wrote that line, I catapult into the future fighting solid air, because I find that very fascinating.
The term solid air is from a Scottish folk singer. His name is John Martin, spelled Martyn, and he has a song called Solid Air, and it's a very simple image, but it's full of contrast. Air is not solid, and what is solid, you know, has resistance that air does not. So I've always liked that term, and it seemed like I could use it there. Catapulting means you're under your own power, you know, you're shooting yourself off, basically, into the future, which we all try to do. We're always projecting into the future, as you were saying. We're always out there ahead of ourselves when, as I said before, I think the only thing we're given is now. So catapulting talks about self-effort. Boxing solid air, if you try to box a solid object, you're going to come away bruised and wounded. But if it's air, you know, how much resistance does that give to you? That kind of represents the future. How much resistance does it give to you? Can you fight your way through the future? Things of that sort. So that's what I was trying to get at with that line and that phrase. But John Martin is worth listening to if you're interested in folk music.
I will definitely have to check that out. Thank you.
Okay.
Arliss, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us tonight. I'm sorry we didn't get further. Please do go check out Arliss' work and check out his set list, the rest of his poems he provided tonight, and his three books from Meadowlark Press are highlighted on his personal page here at All Poetry under Arliss with a D at the end. So thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Thank you all for joining us, and have a lovely evening.
Thank you. I did enjoy it. It's very refreshing. So thanks for inviting me.
Wonderful job. Good night, everyone.
Good night.